Welcome to the Literary License Podcast, European Horror Podcast, with your co-hosts Vicky Ray, Will Millar, and Keith Chalko, exploring the genre from a unique perspective, from extreme to classic, in a world that is set to chill you to the bone.
Welcome to the Literary License Podcast, and today we are dealing with a French 1955 classic called Les Dalobliques. And who is with us today? Vicky Ray is not with us, unfortunately. She is at home, ill, not with the coronavirus, but she is ill from a stomach virus. So we wish her the best and a speedy recovery there.
Get well, Vicky.
And we also have Will. Hello, Will. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing great, Keith. How are you?
Oh, I'm just groovy. Busy, stressed, but hey, the time is flying.
Yeah, I mean, it's what a week, right? You know?
Yeah. Well, it's one to go down, you know? It's like, where were you during 9/11 and the coronavirus, you know? Yeah, something to tell our grandchildren later on in life, so.
We're living history, kids. Ain't it grand?
So I guess we get to our roses and thorns segment. So what's your rose and thorn?
I would say that my rose this week is just, you know, I've throughout the whole week, I've reached out to everyone in my family, all of my friends, you know, the people who I'm really close to. It seems like everyone is pulling through this okay. No major illnesses to speak of or anything like that. So I'm really grateful for that. It's one of those things where when things get completely chaotic like this, it forces you to sort of recalibrate and be very grateful for the things that are, you know, most important in life. And those things are always people. It's always people. So, you know, I'm just grateful that everyone out there seems to be doing all right. And you know, everyone should continue to focus on just staying healthy amidst the chaos.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I've experienced a lot of kindness this week, so
good.
And what's your thorn?
I would say my thorn is we all as American citizens need to be paying very close attention to what is happening to this country economically. The big flashy event is the very real pandemic situation that's sweeping the globe. However, we're sort of seeing a very perhaps mercenary thing happening underneath that, which is the literal $1 trillion a day. The word bailout doesn't even really begin to describe what's happening here. This is an economic catastrophe. And I believe that we, in the next few months, it would behoove a lot of us writers and researchers to not be satisfied with the explanation of big banks anymore. These aren't banks. These are people. Again, these are actual individuals and their forces running the banks. And to just sit there and say, well, it's Chase or it's Citibank, I don't think that works anymore. These are criminals and we need to start holding them accountable.
I totally agree. I think people don't consider that corporations are actually people, which they are. You know, even if they're on a board of directors, they're a group of people who are making decisions for you. First, you know, I think people need to, you know, be a bit more aware of what's going on around them. So I totally agree with you.
Yeah, I believe that they're powerful and they're also dangerous and they've also kind of overstepped their bounds at this point and something needs to happen. You know, hopefully the legal and safe route for everyone is what I pray, but it needs to... We're there, guys. It's not going to get any better for us if we don't start pushing back somehow in some way that's not destructive to the American people.
No, I totally agree. I think that people need to start asking more questions and people need to ask the right questions. So
yeah.
And that's what I tell people all the time, you know, not to get political here, but when people ask me at work, you know, mm-hmm. being an American living over in England, and, you know, they do ask me about America stuff for God knows how, even consider I haven't lived there for almost 30 some odd years now. And, they, you know, they'll ask me, it's like, oh, how did Trump get in? I go, the question is not how did Trump get in? The question is, out of, you know, the huge population of America, these were the two best people they brought forward. That's the question. And it looks like you're going to have another election again with two very questionable people running for office. And no one seems to be demanding something better for themselves.
Yeah, that's the other thing that's sort of, speaking of them kind of soft pedaling something in, I mean, we're witnessing the hijacking of an entire party. The Democratic National Party is a completely corrupt and untrustworthy system that we're actually using to try to decide who's going to run the country. It's like you wouldn't gather together, you know, an actual group of, like, let's go through the sex offender registry and see who we're going to put in charge of Disneyland or something like that. That's a stupid idea. And we've somehow, like, normalized some, allowing some of the worst people in the world to actually run our government. And again, a greater sense of accountability, I think, needs to be sort of implemented. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Blaming the people who voted for Donald Trump in the presidential election is like blaming the hood ornament on the car that ran you over. It's just the first thing to just kind of come your way.
I found, well, we just had an election here in the UK between Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn.
Oh, right.
Jeremy Corbyn had all these great ideas, but no way to implement them. Uh-huh. And then we got Boris as a bit of a buffoon, but because we spent, you know, 2.5, almost 3 years discussing about Brexit and everything, even after we voted, because people didn't want to go with a majority of votes, so they were fighting this. So this went on for quite a few times. Mm-hmm. And people had to vote for that way because they just got sick of listening about this. So it's almost like they got wear down. But when you look at the two candidates, basically you voted for the one you hated the least. And basically, you know, and when I look at the American election that's coming up, and I'm thinking to myself, is like, for the last 4 years, the Democratic Party could have found someone who was fantastic to run up against Trump. Therefore, what you could have is, like, you know, when I want an election, I want a battle of the gladiators. That's what I want. I want people, you know, two great people out there, each one how to implement their slogans that are beyond just the slogan, beyond the words. I want to know how they're going to implement it, and they're basically battling out, like, you know, like Mothra and Godzilla. You know, you want to see this huge fight, you know, based on ideals that they can actually accomplish. And unfortunately, we haven't had that in a very long time, and it's getting a bit depressing. But I find it very, very depressing that people are not asking those questions and not demanding more. You know, at the end of the day, we are paying for these people. We are paying for this. You know, and the thing is, you won't give money to a homeless person on the street because you're afraid they're going to flounder your money, but you're okay giving money, your taxes, and not asking questions. And I think that people need to get out of their headspace, stop thinking about themselves. You know, and let's be honest, we all have equal rights here. Equal rights means being treated like shit, like everyone else. And which basically means that, you know, stop asking for special rights now. Everyone has equal rights. And you know, as far as respectability is concerned, that's going to be based on you. If, you know, unfortunately, you can't expect a populace to respect you. You have to do that on your own. So let's get past that crap and start looking at, you know, something, you know, that's good, more for our buck. Let's start getting what our money's paying for. That's how I look at things. So now I've gone on my political, and I'll make that my thorn, shall I?
Well, I figured we were kind of just soft pedaling our way into that. So there's your thorn.
That's my thorn. So thanks. As my grandmother said, you know, you can't fix stupidity. But anyway, I guess my rose has to be is, and I kind of went into this a bit yesterday. Unfortunately, we're about 1 week behind. That's the reason why I got two episodes coming out, folks. But my rose is, at the moment on Netflix, they're showing all the Ghibli studio films here, like Spirited Away, Princess Mononoke, And I've been watching one a day. I've been working at, the hospital, doing my swabs and being quite stressed coming home and just watching one of those. And I say, what such beautiful films, and they have such beautiful meanings, and the stories are so lovingly put together. And it's amazing to look at as well. So I've been really enjoying that. So that's probably my rose. That's actually saving me from getting a gun and going out and going postal. So.
Yeah, I recommend that to anyone.
So, and of course, I've been catching up on the films that we're covering today, which is Les Dadabliques, which is basically was released as Dadabliques in the United States, variously translated as The Devils or The Fiends. It's a 1955 French psychological horror thriller film directed by Henri-Georges Clouzot, starring Simone Signoret, Vera Clouzot, Paul Merizet, and Charles Bonnel. It is based on the novel She Who Was No More, written by Pierre Boulou and Thomas Nasajak. What's interesting with Pierre Boulou, he also did, he also wrote the book that Vertigo is based on, and first episode that we ever did for the Literary License Podcast, he wrote Planet of the Apes.
Oh, it was Vertigo, yeah.
The story blends elements of thriller and horror with the plot focusing on a woman and her husband's mistress who conspire to murder the man. After the crime is committed, however, his body disappears and a number of strange occurrences ensue. The film was the 10th highest grossing film of the year in France and was a total of 3,674,380 admissions. The film was also received the 1954 Louise Delu Prize, Coulou, right after finishing The Wages of Fear, option to play rights, preventing Alfred Hitchcock from making the film. The movie helped inspire Hitchcock's Psycho by Robert Bloch himself, the author of the novel Psycho, and stated in an interview that his all-time favorite horror film is Les Dadabliques.
Attention. Écoutez. Écoutez.
Ce sera aujourd'hui ou jamais.
Et tu es sûr que ça laisse pas de traces?
Et le scandale? Tu imagines le scandale?
Ça ne peut finir que d'une façon. Sans des monstres, Dieu n'aime pas les monstres.
Oh, j'ai la tête qui éclate, moi. Je vis une histoire de fou.
Ce n'est pas une histoire de fou, c'est une histoire diabolique.
Qui est là?
Une baignoire, diabolique.
Un costume d'homme,
diabolique.
Une malle en osier,
diabolique.
Une piscine.
Qui l'a enfoncé sous l'eau?
What's your thoughts on Les Dadabliques?
It's a great one. It's another one of these sort of groundbreaking films that they call it a thriller. That's the sort of genre that it falls into the most, Les Dadabliques. It is that, but it's also got a lot of other sort of literary genres kind of packed into the DNA. The funny thing is, I was thinking about how Clouzot directed The Wages of Fear, which is it's a pretty intense movie, and I believe that, I don't know if this is true or not, and I'm not sure if this is something that you know, Keith, or can find out, but I'm pretty sure that the movie Sorcerer that William Friedkin did in the 70s is a remake of The Wages of Fear.
I believe it is, actually, movie. It is.
Yeah, yeah. So I was thinking about how a lot of Clouzot is very much like a, you know, a European analog to some of Hitchcock's earlier work. These guys aren't just sort of the progenitor of the scary movie genre, but also the blockbuster genre, because movies like The Wages of Fear and Sorcerer also led to movies like The French Connection, which sort of kind of ballooned out into the more action-heavy 80s movies. But at the same time, Les Diaboliques is it's written by, like you said, Pierre Boileau and Thomas. I'm not even going to try to pronounce that name. My French is diabolical, to pardon the pun. But so they're actually pulling from the literary style known as pessimism. And pessimism is famous for featuring stories with these that are centered around these mustache tweezing villains. You know, you've got Paul Maurice is just this evil human being who is really the focal point of the whole story. It's not a happy story by any means, and it doesn't end well for anyone either. But I would say that this movie this movie and the book borrow a lot from a book written in the early 1900s by an American named Edgar Saltis, called The Misadventures of Mr. Incool, who's about this guy who, you know, beats his girlfriend and cheats on his wife with his girlfriend and rapes his wife and then poisons her and kind of just gets away with it and starts to woo another lady. And that's actually basically the whole plot, but that was the style of pessimism. It's actually, it's a descendant of the decadent style that started in France with writers like jurist Carl Wiesmans, who wrote like Against the Grain and Down There, which was one of the first books to talk openly about Satanism. So there's a whole lot to unpack, I guess, with the style of this movie. Not to say the least of which, it's one of those early ones that sort of hints at a lesbian relationship as the central focus, even though that's not ever really stated overtly in the film. I think it's pretty much underlined that that's the connection.
It's funny that you bring that up, because the actual book, and due to, you know, 1955 sensibilities, is the book that the triangle remains the same. But it's actually the husband and girlfriend that try to get rid of the wife. And then what transpires at the end of it is that the wife isn't dead. The husband ends up dying from a heart attack, and the wife and the mistress get away with murder as a lesbian couple.
Interesting. Okay. So yeah, there it is.
And I imagine that Clouzot, if you read anything about him, he's quite an interesting character. And he was from making films during World War II. And it's not because he's making Germany propaganda films or anything like this. Basically, he came out with a film. I don't know what the French name is, but it was the English termination. I think that the English title was The Raven.
Okay.
Basically, the story has to do with someone taking this small town and sending them an ominous letter that tears this town apart. And at that time, when this movie came out, Germany had occupied France in World War II. And so what happened is, and there's, no disrespect to French people today, but France pretty much just kind of laid back and let this happen. And so to show support for Germany, because they were the major force at that time during World War II, they basically turned their back on him. The Germany turned their back on him, then they prevented him from making any films until he did Wings of Fear. And also the Resistance were against him because they thought this was a love letter for Germany. So
That's funny.
If you get a chance to see the film, it's quite an interesting film. And I'll try to find the links to see if there's any place you can find them to see this film, because it's one of these films that actually could be done very, very well today. So I think that what happened, so going back to Les Blalabiques, is that this is a man who has a lot of controversy. And I think that he probably, thinking the controversy that he had, I'm pretty sure at this time that these films were being made that the French government actually was funding films. And I'm sure that he probably would have made it more strictly to the book, but I'm pretty sure they stepped in. So but there is that lesbian vibe still. And I'm kind of wondering if he just go, I'm going to sneak this in because I still want that questionable, bit of subtext going on. So,
no, I mean the every scene between Simone Signoret and Vera, Christina De La Salle, I'm trying to remember her name, Vera Clouseau, they're just smoldering together, and there's all the chemistry is between them, and it's very interesting to view this movie almost as a time capsule from 55 years ago that actually was, brave enough to kind of do that and do it in a way that it's there. There's no way there's no way that this story moves forward if those two aren't, romantically linked. And everyone watching this knows it, but nobody can say anything about it. It's a secondary source of tension throughout the movie that Clouseau's very good at. He's very good at doing a lot with a single, frame or a single scene. This is a movie that's sort of it's a continually building nightmare. Just all of the tricks that he does with the framing, where people are constantly separated from each other by partitions and these little wooden slats that look like prison bars. The whole place is set up like a labyrinth, and everyone who approaches either Vera or Simone or Christina and the two ladies, they all look like gargoyles. He's doing a whole lot with a great little. Whoa, he's doing a whole lot with every shot.
I also found what I like about this film as well is there's so much subtext, because the story is not told by what they're saying. The story is told by the glances that the characters are giving to each other. Absolutely. And I found that very, very interesting, because what's coming out their mouth is totally not coming. Is not what's being displayed by their eyes. Mm-hmm. And it's quite interesting it's almost like Two-Face, I guess, is sort of things where your mouth is saying one thing, but your eyes are saying something else. And all the characters are doing this. The only characters aren't doing this are kids. And I guess that's because the innocence of kids, they kind of just say what they see. Uh-huh. And they're the only ones with the honest expressions and the honest words coming out of their mouth. But all the adults, and even down to the fact that I think that, everything is very subtle in the film until they go to Nuro. Basically to Christine, I keep wanting to call her Christine, but that's probably, I'm probably getting her stuck up with Nicole. Nicole, when they go to Nicole's house and the only time you see this blatantly done is when Nicole goes up to her neighbor's house, and then and then she goes back down in the bath running. So that's where you actually get to see where it's played in your face. But everywhere else in the movie, it's very, very subtle. And I thought that was quite interesting. And you even get it with the school teacher sort of thing.
Yep. Yeah. There's all those little signals. They talk about the Roman decadence of the two of them as they're carrying on downstairs. I thought it was sorry, I'm losing my train of thought here. But you're right. They did that a lot. They created a lot of cognitive dissonance between the words that were being said and how they're being emoted. It was everything, again, it's another one of these things that you see in a lot of European films that you don't see in the American ones, which is a sort of dream logic unfolding in a lot of scenes. You know, characters are, their motivations, they're less informed by the story than by what can be sort of achieved artistically sometimes.
I also found that if you watch the film and you see the action going on, which is quite interesting, that every scene that you see with Nicole and Christina, all their scenes are done in sets that are decaying, molding. Yeah. Everything around them is decaying. And the only time that you see no decay is when you got Nicole finding her husband's mistress suite. Apartment. And that's the only one that's pristine and new. But if you notice that, it's only pristine and new because none of his stuff's in there, which is quite interesting. And I quite like the, this is one of these films. I mean, I think I saw this film at a film festival when I was in college, and it always kind of struck me. And I bought, you know, they came out with a Blu-ray of it, and I did buy the Blu-ray because it's one of those movies that I do love.
Yes.
Because every time I do watch it, I do notice a little bit more, and it just kind of grows on you. And the performances are very odd, but they do work.
Yeah, he's creating gargoyles out of a lot of the characters. You look at like Monsieur Drain, he's kind of like the cruel tutor, and his face is all just kind of, you know, he's grimacing at everyone from behind that mustache of his. And then you know, who's the detective, Charles Vanel, you know, he's sort of, his face is just very grim, and he's all hunched over, and he keeps grabbing Vera by the, or Christina De La Salle. Every time she's got to go somewhere, and he's got her by the arm, and you just want to be like, let go of her, motherfucker. You know, it's all very intense, and none of it's accidental. Like you said, you know, the whole scene, the thing that you pointed out, which I didn't notice, you know, Michelle De La Salle's, you know, sort of corrupting influence and everything. What I thought with all the decay was, again, another sort of literary allusion to go back to was like the sort of gothic stories. This also kind of reminded me, especially towards the end, as Christina De La Salle is creeping through the school in her very sort of flowy see-through nightgown, it sort of reminded me of like The Mysteries of Udolpho, which is like an old Anne Rampling novel from like the 1700s. What they called bodice ripping.
The old book covers where you got like the woman in the night. With a candlestick going up an old staircase or something.
Exactly that. Yes. So that's kind of, and I, you know, you can't have a castle in a modern day sort of story that they're trying to tell, but you can have this very old, creepy, you know, orphanage that sort of unfolds almost like a castle as she's moving through it, you know?
You know, I found that it's quite interesting because watching the film this time, and because, you know, as most of our people know, when you're doing something for a podcast, you tend to watch films slightly different than what you normally, than how I would normally watch them. And they're kind of, you know, going back to what you said about William Friedkin and about, you know, him making his remake.
Yeah,
making an English version of it, but then that totally makes sense because if you look at the detective in this movie, it's the same detective he used in The Exorcist. The same style of acting, same dress and everything. So it does make a lot of sense.
You're absolutely right. Holy cow! He has the same walk, the same sort of like the same grim, like grimacing face. You're right, they
the way he puts his sentences together where he's asking a question but he's not really asking a question, you know, if you look at, when you watch The Exorcist, when you got the detective going through, you know, he's mentioning like something that's totally offbeat, like some kind of weird movie that no one's ever heard of, and then bringing us on a question, and then when he doesn't get the answer, because don't worry, I totally understand, and same thing, it's quite interesting.
His whole style throughout the whole movie, you're right, they're dead ringer from one another. That's amazing. That's absolutely it. Wow. I'm going to have to go back and watch The Exorcist now. That's really cool.
Well, another thing, and this is like totally thinking about, I was doing a little bit of research about when this film was released in America, that the Americans that saw this film upon this release were considered sophisticated and very worldly. Mm-hmm. Now, and basically I think America got it by a year later. So we're looking at 56, 57 by the time it hit America. Right. Now, if you watch Grease and you look at the Rizzo's character, the way that Rizzo's dressed, the way that she looks, she's basically Simone Signac in this movie. And which basically means that I don't know how much Stockard Channing had put into her character as far as, you know, what decisions she could make about her dress. But it almost like, so we look at the sort of Rizzo, that Rizzo is worldly. She's kind of a bit more sophisticated than everyone else. She's kind of like, she owns her sexuality, and which is kind of like, I nod to, Nicole's character in Les Dobliques. And if you look at the time period that Grease is, makes sense.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. The other movie that the quite obvious one that that riffed a lot on this was House on Haunted Hill. I mean, it's just,
well, Tingler as well, didn't it? Because Tingler, the bathroom sequence.
Yes. Oh yeah. I didn't think of that. Absolutely. Oh, man. Yeah.
Yes, there's to be honest, when I was watching it, I knew the sequence was coming up, and I am a huge, like yourself, I'm a huge William Castle fan. Yeah. And then when that happened, I thought to myself, like, isn't this in color?
That's so funny.
Like, no, that's the Tingler. Okay. But I actually put the connection today with that sort of thing. So I think this movie's got a lot to answer for, because it actually helped America's cinema kind of changed slightly after this movie was released.
I think so. Like I said originally, I believe that this was one of those movies that sort of blew the doors off for a lot of other filmmakers who kind of watched and go, oh, I can do that. You know, I can tell a story like this. Because it's very singular in the way that it's told, but you can sort of see where a lot of people, a lot of very talented filmmakers later on kind of dipped from this well. It's an homage, but...
Even Hitchcock dipped from this well with Psycho, didn't he, really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely.
Yeah. Even
this
with,
was
like...
the movie, this was, he couldn't make this, so he made Psycho. Isn't that the story?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, another thing is that if you look at the way that Psycho structured with the whole thing about don't tell anyone about the ending, this film came first, and I think this is the first film that actually does that. Don't tell anyone what you've just seen, that don't be diabolical. And then if you look at William Castle afterwards and Alfred Hitchcock, they did the same thing when he released Psycho. Do not reveal the ending of this movie. Don't tell your friends.
The back when filmmakers were still sort of part of the hustle, you know, it's funny now you look at the way that they market films now, movie going is a different experience now than it was back then. And that's the understatement of the century in this day and age. But they were filming in the 50s and 60s was a different sort of medium back then.
Well, I think what it basically was, from my understanding, from what my parents had told me, that they would go to they would always go to dinner after they went to the film, because there never was a late, late show normally, from what my mom was telling me. So what they would do, they would, her and her friends would go to the movie, and then they go out to dinner, and then they would discuss the movie, and they would discuss everything. Right. And I think that what we do now is we kind of see movies now in a different way. We see them and then we just throw them away and don't think about them again, especially the modern movie. But then again, we are being fed a lot by corporations telling us.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot to discuss after a movie like, I can't even think of, well, I mean, that's not true. I mean, there's a lot of good ones that came out this year, but, you know, the big blockbusters.
Yeah, they're very far in between. There's not a lot of artistic stuff coming out. I mean, there are, I mean, you got Midsommar and movies like that.
This was really good. I haven't seen The Color Out of Space, but I'm hearing mostly positive things about that. I
heard positive things about Parasite, so I'll be interested to see that at some point.
Oh, yeah, that's another one.
Huh. But, I mean, most of the movies we do get tend to be more of the equal duplex movies. They seem to take over. And every once in a while, we do get some kind of small little artistic film that does kind of squeak in somewhere. But But I do think that there seemed to be at some point, I would say up until about 2000, that we used to get quite a few of these little independent films. There seemed to be more money spent on this kind of thing. But I think that, for personally, I do think this probably has more to do with people, they were corporations, but they weren't owned by big corporations. And I think they would take chances to see what they would throw stuff at things and see if what would sell and what doesn't. But now I think everything's bottom line. So I think that's when everything becomes bottom line, I think you do lose a bit of artistic license. That should be
no doubt.
But I do think that Label Obliques is, there's so much little symbolisms and little things that mean stuff, you know, and I like that, you know, like for instance, when, you know, the way that she's dressed, the way, you know, she's dressed like Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz, you know, Christina.
Absolutely, yeah. She's got the same hair, sort of the same look, and she's from Venezuela, so she's literally a fish out of water, you know, transplanted into this post-World War II France that's very much, you know, she's basically in a prison in almost every frame of the movie you're watching. It's just a slow dissolve. You're watching the disillusion of a human being from the beginning to the end of the movie. You know,
she does have that Alice in Wonderland thing as well. Did you notice that her makeup is that she's always wide-eyed?
Oh, like, yeah.
And then, but then you get Simone
Signoret. Yeah.
And the thing is that if you look at her, if you ever notice, her eyes are kind of like sly, always on the side sort of thing. And it's quite a nice little contrast because you got this wide-eyed girl being taken by the hand into this murderous wonderland and the dark underworld that she's being led to by this sly woman. And you kind of do wonder, and the thing is that you do kind of wonder with, for me, is Christina just very naive, or is she just not very worldly, or is she just, I know that Christianity tends to hold her back.
That's an interesting aside for her too, because you can sort of see that she's conflicted, you know, between being a lesbian and being Christian, even though they never actually sort of, we haven't given this guy nearly enough credit. Clouseau does such a great job of basically telling a story without actually telling the story, which is her just being, you know, torn between, you know, what she wants and what she believes to be right. And you know, in answer to your question, I think she's just a prisoner throughout. This is a movie where they explain how the ghost of the, you know, the woman in the white dress seen flitting through the abandoned orphanage. Like, this is sort of the prequel to that story, because you know that that's where she's going to end up. She dies, and now she's haunting that place forever, you know? That's what I see, is I see a ghost story prequel in this, you know.
I did find it, her character, very, very interesting, because I'm a bit torn about her, which is kind of, I mean, she's one of these characters that in some parts she's extremely strong, because she does put up with the abuse that her husband gets her. I mean, her husband does rape her at one point. She does get up.
I know.
You know, she's very, very strong. And then you do kind of wonder, and there's like, and then you have the mistress. And then we are led to believe that he hit the mistress and that this is a normal occurrence. But by the end of the movie, I'm not quite sure that, I think that might just been for show. Sort of thing. But, and you kind of look at the situation and you kind of think, when does the wife become best friends with the mistress without realizing that maybe the mistress doesn't have the wife's best interest at heart? And is it because Christina's at such a low in her life that and a low self-opinion of herself that this woman's giving her kind words and encouragement and strength, so therefore she's being led blindly? But you know, so you're kind of thinking this, but then of course you get scenes like when they're in the car and they're going to do their plan about murdering her husband, and then when they're coming back from murdering the husband, and then she's going to call the police, and you get these scenes where she basically challenges Nicole, and she has kind of has the upper hand, and she's kind of, you know, she's not being led by the hand, and she does stand up. But then you also get scenes where she doesn't stand up. So she's kind of a conflicting character, because you're never quite sure, is she a strong character or is she a weak character? Mm-hmm. And that's what makes her quite an interesting character. I mean, Simone Signet is kind of like, you know, she's strong, you see her sort of thing. And even though this is the actor, the director's wife, and I have to sit there and say, mm-hmm. Rob Zombie, you might want to take a note here. When you keep casting your wife, you might want to start playing to her strengths. But she does a fantastic job, because it's very conflicted about. You can't stop watching her. I think she's quite an amazing, beautiful woman to look at.
She's luminous. Yeah, I mean, you know. She has that thing that those old Hollywood or you know, old film stars had, that sort of luminosity. I would say that, you know, this is, again, the genius of not just Clouseau, but the original writers of this story, Boileau and Narcissac, or however you say his name. What this is Simone's character, Nicole, Miss Horner, makes a lot more sense if Christine is a guy, because then she's your femme fatale, because that's exactly what she is in this movie. She's the seductress. She seduced the one to poison the other. However, in this case, because Christine is a lady, the purpose of the femme fatale within the noir subgenre gets flipped on its head, because you can't really call her a seductress, not overtly, otherwise you blow the whole game here, which is, you know, you can't really point to the fact that they're romantically linked, even though they are. And let's just say, even to the point where Madame Horner actually penetrates Christina with the hypodermic towards the end of the needle. She penetrates him right in the ass. And you see, just like in the rape scene, afterwards, you don't actually see this shot going in, but you do see Christina kind of pulling her skirt back down, just like you saw Christina playing with her skirt after she got raped by Michelle in the earlier scene.
I see that now, actually. Didn't think about it, but now that you bring it up, it's like, yeah, okay, this makes sense. And let's face it, they were fucking her up the ass, really. Figuratively.
It was real. This is a rough ride for Christina. Like I said, she's the ghost that you see in that orphanage 10 years down the road. This is the story of how she got there. And it's rough. I mean, it's rough all the way through.
I found another thing that was quite interesting is that, you know, you got the rest of the staff. And I didn't, I found this very, very strange. It's very compelling, and it does work within the confines of the movie. But when I started thinking about that, you have these teachers who see everything that's going on, don't comment it, don't want to get involved. They see the abuse, and that's fine. It's almost like, and I'm not quite sure, is it because they're so self-involved about themselves that they want to make sure that they keep their jobs? Do they think, well, these women are adults, they were making their own decisions, so I'm just staying out of it? Or it's like, well, fine, just as long as he's picking on them, he's leaving me alone? Because, I mean, the husband is a bully to every sense of the word. He'd be bullying everyone.
He's the worst.
And so,
it's funny that you mention that. I wonder about that a lot with certain films, like, characters exist to make a point of cowardice. You watch it, and it's a very unsettling experience when you see somebody on screen hit somebody else in front of somebody else, and that other person doesn't do anything, or they act in a very cowardly and callow manner. It sort of makes you feel kind of helpless to watch that. And maybe that's, again, we're talking about an effective thriller has, like, multiple points of tension. It's not just the villain on screen, but you're freaked out by all the cognitive dissonance and by the uncomfortable sex and by the weird changes in people's, you know, behavior that never gets quite explained. There's all these different things that add up in a good thriller to just kind of make you go, what the fuck is going on here? And I think that with those cowardly characters, who, you know, you watch them, and again, what's his name? Oh my goodness, I'm so bad at this today. Monsieur Drain, he's doing so much grimacing and so much flapping of his arms at these kids. He looks almost like a monster, and you get that a lot with these characters. They're very Dickensian, and like you said, they're cowardly and self-involved, and these are not the sort of people that you want in charge of a bunch of children at all.
Yeah, I had to wonder what kind of classes and these kids are coming from. But then one kid said that the chauffeur's picking up his clothes. I was like, well, obviously some of these kids are coming from money. What are these parents doing?
Do you think that they're coming from money? Because I got the impression that this was post-World War II and there was just a lot of orphans and displaced people because everything was fucking bombed to shit and the country was just basically rebuilding itself.
Well, the kids were going home for... For holiday too.
So they have
homes, so they're not orphans. And no. I thought maybe the kids were probably just like working class kids, maybe trying to get a
Yeah, I don't know what.
But then when you get one kid going, that where's your luggage? And he goes, oh, the chauffeur's going to pick it up. That's what the chauffeur's paid for. And you're like,
oh, that's
okay. Right. Well, that kid's rich. So it's like, kind of wondering. It's like, okay, what kind of parents are sending their kids to such a rundown school?
Yeah, they're eating rotten
The money
fish
wasn't going to their education. I mean, the husband was philandering all the money. I mean, he's buying fish that just almost gone off and the food that he was serving and, you know, which is basically how they open. But yet at the same time, you know, he's got his principal suit. He has his own, like, upscale apartment in the city. Uh-huh. He's got, you know, money to spend on his mistresses. Apparently there's quite a few of them that we find out, which I know that they say a couple times here, but you never quite understand how the mistress feels about these other mistresses. So you don't really get.
Yeah. You kind of wonder why all these people are together and what they see in each other. And again, I was kind of watching it and had kind of assumed that because of, again, just the insane amount of collateral damage that France had gone through, you know, between like up until like 47 or so, that the country was just kind of rebuilding itself, that there weren't a lot of guys around, because who the fuck wants to put up with this idiot? Like he's just the worst. Everything about him is horrible. Every time that he's on, like, every expression on his face makes you want to slap him. And he's, you know, he's a good actor. He's doing that on purpose, but he's not
attractive. There's nothing sexual about him. It's not like it's Tyrone Power playing a really horrible person. This person, he's a really good character, but I don't think it was a sex symbol. And there's nothing sexual coming off him. If anything, there, you know, it's just. You know, sometimes I like. Sometimes you can be the villain, and then you know, and I sit there and say that you know the villain is an abusive to the wife or something like this, or you know, they were in this, and there's normally something quite sexual or something going on behind it that you can go, well, okay, I can understand why she's falling for it. She shouldn't be dealing with this, but I can understand why.
Yeah,
but you don't really understand what the attraction to this guy is because. Yeah, there's not one. He's not even charming. He doesn't even switch from being charming to being, you know, switching it on and off. He's one personality, which is quite a revolting personality from the moment that you see him all the way to the end. He never puts on the charm offensive for anybody.
Yeah, and that's where I got that's where I got the Mr. Incool's Mr. Misadventure vibe from him. He's definitely a character out of Edgar Saltis. He's also he's the devil from the Brothers Karamazov. If you think of the Brothers Karamazov at the end, what's his name meets the devil, and it's this overweight, unemployed salesman with a tear in his trousers. And the longer that you stare at him, the more kind of irritated you get just by the very presence of him. And that's sort of Michelle's purpose in this movie. Everything about him is like you said, it's reprehensible. He's oily. Like that's when you look at him on screen, you get the impression that if you touched his face, you'd have to go wash your hands. He's an oily, you know, just a gross person. And there's almost every man in the movie, if you realize is either feckless or outright hideous. So yeah. That kind of ratchets up the nightmare world that Christina lives in. And again, kind of underscores the idea that she would seek solace in the arms of the tall, broad-shouldered blonde woman who's, you know, so commanding in every scene that she's in.
I thought, you know, but then again, I guess if knowing about the source material and if they stuck to the source material, the weak character who would, I mean, I'm sorry, the wife would have been the husband character, which would have been played by a female. And the put upon wife would have been the husband. So it would have been quite interesting to see how that would have played out. Because can you imagine like a hard as nailed woman playing that part? And then, and I wonder if we would, but I kind of wonder if we would have the same kind of reaction. Because I wonder how it played out.
I don't think it would have been as frightening. This movie is frightening, or at the very least, it's unsettling because there's no way out for Christina. And you see that very early on. And there's just, it's relentless. I mean, you know, it starts bad for her and it ends bad. And you're kind of just strapped in. But Clouzot does it in a way where you're engaged with the movie, even though you know that you're in for a real bummer towards the end. And he does it through, like, you know, the beautiful way that it's shot and these this sort of, again, continuous ratcheting of tension, and everything's a surprise the whole way through, you know, and it's there's not a lot of movies like this, and I don't think that you could have done that if it was flipped to where there was, you know, the guy kind of moving through the maze like this.
Yeah. Oh no. Of course. I mean, you know, in his 1950s PJs wouldn't have the same kind of feel to it. Is Darren Stevens from Bewitched on PJs
with like a floppy nightcap on too? For sure.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's a complicated film. It's not a complicated film to watch, but it's a complicated film because you have complicated characters in a situation, but you know, your eyes can't, it's a kind of a strange situation because you're watching this and let's face it, none of the characters are nice characters, as you were saying. And even the nice character, which is the wife, she's kind of irritates you because she doesn't get her chance to ever stand up for herself. She doesn't stand up for herself. So you're just seeing this woman go through this. And you find out that she's the one with the money. She's the one that actually can hold the purse strings if she wanted to. And at the one time she says, well, I'm going to get a divorce. And, you know, and you're thinking to yourself, it's like, well, you actually know that this is your option. You don't play it. So she's infuriating. There's something very infuriating about her whole situation. But at the same time, you can't avert your eyes away from this because it is like one of the worst blood TV. You know, it's like watching a Jerry Springer situation brought to life in France, you know, where you get these people trapped in their lives, but no one's actually doing anything about it. And and no one's taking responsibility for themselves in this kind of situation. And I think that's what makes, you know, makes this one of, I mean, I know, like, I have my list of, like, top films, and this does fit into some of my top films because it does I quite like those complicated characters and no easy answers, and even when they, you know, and when they do look for a way out, it's very complicated for the way out as well. So, and I think that's where Les Delibliques kind of works very, very well, is when you have all this complication settled in people who are just trying to get by, it seems like.
Yeah, it's a rough ride, you know. This is not one of those ones to feel better about.
And I guess, I mean, one final scene I think we should mention is when he forces her to eat the fish, and you have the teeth around them, you got the kids, and they've been sold, this fish has gone off, and then he's eating a steak.
Oh my God, I know. Yeah,
and you got and the guy goes, "Go, can I have another glass of wine, please?" The other teacher is like, "Go have. Have you had two already? No, I've only had the one. Okay, you can have one more then." And that is watered down wine that we find out later. And then he forces her to eat, and they just all accept it. And even the mistress, who's supposed to be her friend and supporting her, doesn't even. She says kind of the odd eyes crack every once in a while, but it's kind of an interesting, it's heart-wrenching to watch. And she's crying and she's, you know, looks like she's about to throw up at any moment.
Yeah.
And I think that pretty much, when that scene happens, you kind of get a nice understanding what's going on, but you know, you're kind of getting, you're waiting, the movie's, you know, pulling you in and taking you into this nightmare world as you were stating. But at that point, you realize, okay, this is the world I'm in. And I have to say, that's probably the defining moment of the film when you actually realize, like, okay, this is what's going to, you know, this is when you start to realize what you just stepped into.
Yeah.
Like, oh, okay.
So,
I guess we get to our final thoughts. So what are your final thoughts of Les Dollars Bleus?
My final thoughts are, it's a great movie. It's a tough one to watch. We've that's kind of our thing here. We watch these European horror movies, and a lot of them are, they're horror movies, so they don't end well for very many people, if anyone. This one, for it's probably one of the more restrained ones that we've done. It's probably the least violent movie, I think, out of anyone that we've actually talked about. But for me, this is one of the ones that's really hard to watch, just because of you're just watching a human being get bullied for 2 hours until she finally dies, and that's essentially. But that's the reason not to watch it. The reason to watch it is that as a film, as a piece of, you know, art, as a transformation of literature into celluloid, or however you want to call it, this is actually a very well done bit of dark fiction. And if pessimism and decadence and the whole gothic sort of style is something that you find that you enjoy watching, this is a great movie in that regard. So anyway, that's my take on it.
Personally, I there's a lot of this film I really, really, I mean, everything about this film I like. I like that, as I said before, the complication of the characters. It's not, there's no black and white in this film whatsoever. It's just all just like totally shades of gray against a black and white landscape. And I really do like that. And I do like, and there's like the little things, like everywhere they are looks lived in. I think this is the only movie I've seen where everything looks lived in. The beds are, you know, the beds are not crisp. They're like, you can see that that someone's made them, but someone sat on the bed at some point. It's like, and all this, but it gives you so much information visually, and the visual styles and the 1955 gothic feeling about it, but yet at the same time it works on different levels. Like, it's a domestic movie, but yet it's a horror movie, but yet it's a gothic movie, and it kind of blends everything into this quite fascinating world, and that I don't think any movie has ever been able to equal this or surpass this to the extent of the way that this blends everything together in the way that it does.
Yeah, it's rather singular in that.
Yeah, and it does feel kind of, but at the same time, it has kind of a soap opera feeling to it as well, because everything's there's every once in a while, you got Christine with her heightened emotions, and then you got Nicole with her cool exterior, and then you got the bumbling undertaker, and then you got the sloppy teacher, then you got the, I guess I'm assuming, the other teacher may be gay.
I was wondering that too. Is he gay, or is he just one of those people who is self-involved to a point where he's almost asexual?
He said that he wanted to spend the weekend naked.
Okay.
Then the head teacher says that he has to stay behind and watch the kids. At that time, I thought to myself, like, you go, oh, I just can't wait to just be naked for the whole week. And I thought to myself, like, well, that's a bit odd.
It's a troubling thing. Yeah, it's all bad.
And if you look at all the other males in this movie, is that they're not polished and they're kind of rough and ready. And even the husband that's supposed to be, polished is not really that polished. He's kind of like, fine.
No,
but,
he's oily. Yeah.
Yeah. And but then this teacher here is very clean and pristine looking. And I know in the 50s, normally when we got that, normally we get like Tony Randall in these kind of roles, if it was an American film or something like that.
Oh,
like,
sure.
Those characters are always known to be homosexual, and because because they're always very clean, there's not, you know, I mean, let's put it this way. If you're on the street and you're going to get in a fight, you don't want this guy with you.
No. Yeah, he was, regardless of, we can definitely agree whether or not he liked men or women, he was definitely a fop. You know, he's a foppish human being, and definitely not somebody that you want in a clutch situation at all. So.
And normally there's two ways of looking at that kind of a person, is that they normally come from money.
Yes.
And so therefore they can afford to be a bit effeminate. But this guy he's working at the school, so obviously he doesn't come from money. So that's why I assume that he was homosexual. But I could be wrong here. Making an assumption. So, but I guess that brings us to the end of Lady Dalbleak. So I'm just letting you know that next week we'll be doing our Dark Shadows episodes, and our next European horror is the Dario Argento's Profundo Rosso, or the English title Deep Red.
I'm so excited about this one. It's one of my favorites. So.
Yes, I love Profundo Rosso. I can't wait to dip my toes into that one. So, and of course, if you listen to Literary License Podcast, make sure you sign up to our website at www.llpodcast.com and sign up to our subscription list. And of course, we'll be having our competitions, which come out in our newsletter, and you can win yourself a Literary License Podcast hoodie. And of course, you can find us on all your social medias. Of course, it's Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, Pinterest, so on and so forth. And of course, we are on your favorite platforms, which include Podbean, YouTube, SoundCloud, iTunes Radio, Cashbox Radio, Spotify, and various other platforms of your choice. So make sure you're with us next week for Dark Shadows. So it's good night for myself and good night, Will.
Good night, Will.
And I'll see you next week for Dark Shadows.
Get well, Vicky.
Literary License Podcast Production, and this was my world.